This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening, this is Rock Cash, your host this week on A People Speak. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen by phone calling 716-748-0144. Or if you have a smartphone or a computer, go to bbsradio.com, navigate to station 2, click on the listen icon. You can also participate during the show with calling questions for our guests, toll-free USA and Canada, 888-429-5471. Tonight's guest, Allison Weir, a journalist with a passion for truth, the executive of an organization called The Americans New, also an author of a book called Against Our Better Judgment, The History of How the United States Was Used to Create Israel. She brings to light the struggle of the Palestinians and the suffering that they had gone through. Allison, welcome to The People Speak.
Hi, thank you for inviting me on your show.
You know, Allison, I've never been so compelled to read a book as I have yours, because there's so much truth and there's so much factual evidence that you're pointing out about so many different things. A lot of Palestinians know what actually has been happening to them, but a lot of American Jews don't realize what has happened to them to make them a part of this atrocity that has been going on in the Middle East. Can you please elaborate on your book some, and then we can go into questions from our audience?
I'd be glad to. I think my book, as you mentioned, is specifically about the history of how the U.S.-Israel special relationship was created, and also about how the United States itself was used to create Israel. What I discovered, I just stumbled onto this issue. I really had never thought I would look into this topic before. But in fall of 2000, I just got curious about the issue. I don't happen to be Jewish or Arab or Muslim. So like most people, I had never paid much attention to it before. But when I looked into it, I noticed the news reports were Israeli-centric, that we weren't getting the whole story. I looked for the whole story, and eventually I traveled over to the West Bank in Gaza in early 2001 as a freelance reporter, just to find out to see what was really going on there. And when I came back, I started the organization that you mentioned, If Americans Knew. Ever since, starting at that time, I started to read books about the history of this issue, and I especially looked into the U.S. connection, to find out why we had such a close relationship with Israel. And what I discovered is that the reason Israel was created, there was originally no violence in Palestine at the beginning of the 1900s, the late 1800s. It was, the region was called Palestine, it was under the Ottoman Empire, and it was inhabited by Muslims, Christians, and Jews. About 80% Muslim, about 15% Christian, and a little under 5% Jewish, all living together without problems, as they had done for centuries. There are ancient synagogues, there are ancient churches, they weren't wiping each other out. So what I discovered is there was a movement called political Zionism. It was not a religious movement at all. The leaders, in fact, were largely agnostics or atheists. But what they wanted was a Jewish state in Palestine. The movement began in Europe, but very quickly it was active in the United States as well. As I said, beginning the late 1800s, it was active in the United States to push a political ideology and a movement in which Palestine, that originally was 95% non-Jewish, would be turned into a Jewish state through immigration and colonization. One of the things I discovered at the beginning is that not only was it active in the United States early on, but it was very manipulative, because most Americans were not in favor of Zionism, including Jewish Americans. Jewish Americans for many decades did not agree with Zionism. They felt that their home and their loyalties were to America, and there was no interest in going over to the Middle East, somewhere where they really felt they had no significant connection. They were Americans. But Zionism worked very hard. By 1910, there were 20,000 Zionists, and by Zionist, that means a member of this political movement to create a Jewish state in what was called Palestine. So by 1910, there were 20,000 members. They were already becoming significant to politicians, especially in the larger cities where they had a presence and were starting to make their wants known, and ambitious politicians were already paying attention to them. So I think two of the things that were... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. So it's just been a big deception on most Americans and most Europeans, as far as anyone would know.
It has been... Much of it has been very misrepresented. The history of the region is misrepresented. The history of what went on in the United States has been largely buried. The facts about what's going on now are usually distorted or buried. So it's been a very strange, very damaging situation where I feel truthfully it's damaging to everyone. Many of us know it's causing extreme suffering and misery to Palestinians and other people throughout the region. But I feel that Israelis also are damaged by participating in an extremely unjust situation in which they are oppressing others. That's not a healthy situation either for the oppressor or the oppressee. And yet it's been going on for over 60 years now.
Yeah, that it has. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that there are still refugees out there that are still in tents in Jordan and in Lebanon and in Syria and many parts of the Middle East that have been displaced by the Zionists.
Well, there are refugee populations throughout those areas, often living in great poverty, extremely hard lives in Gaza. Many of the people that live in Gaza were pushed out of what is now Israel. There was an indigenous population in Gaza, of course, but many, where Israel was now, when Israel was created through warfare in the period 1947 through 1949, they pushed out over 750,000 people. That was about half to two-thirds of all of the people that lived on the land originally were pushed out. Very ruthlessly, there were a number of massacres. They ended up throughout the region, and a lot of them are in the West Bank. Many are also in Gaza. Now, Gaza has just been attacked again last summer, where 2,000 people were killed. I believe over half of them were civilians. Many of them were children. Their infrastructure was once again destroyed quite a bit. Many hospitals were destroyed. They were left with over 100,000 people homeless, over 10,000 people injured, and just more and more suffering. It goes on year after year.
And I think the American people are pretty much kept in the dark, and they're stifled because of the one-sidedness of the Zionist media. Is that what's going on? That's the problem? That we're not getting the truth from our government representatives and our media.
That's right. The media is covering this very poorly. They are covering... There really is such a bias towards Israel. I think some of it is unintentional. Some of it, I suspect, is intentional in some cases. So that, for example, we did some studies of media coverage of deaths among both populations. And I think you and your listeners probably agree with me that every death is a tragedy. You know, regardless, when a child is killed, I think we're enormously saddened, no matter the race, religion, ethnicity, or nationality of that child. Children should not be killed, but many are being killed in this conflict and in other conflicts. In the case of Palestine, many more Palestinian children have been killed than Israeli children right from the start. In the current round of violence that began in the fall of 2000, approximately 91 Palestinian children were killed before a single Israeli child was killed. And yet the media always report Israeli actions as though they are retaliating, when many studies have shown it's the exact opposite. They're also reporting on Israeli deaths at rates, you know, often 15 times greater than they're reporting on Palestinian deaths. So that people that listen to or watch or read the American media often are not aware that many, that large numbers of Palestinian civilians and children have been killed by Israeli forces, many more than Israelis have been killed, and that they were killed first, because they are so rarely reported on.
Well, from the beginning, it doesn't seem like the Israelis have any regard for human life or any regard for the lives of children. It seems that they were targeting children back in the in 1948 when they created the state, and also targeting Christians. This is something that's been kept out of the limelight here in the United States. How were they able to keep that out of the news? I know there was a lot of American representatives, according to your book, that were going up against this, but yet they were stifled by the Zionists.
That's right. Just to make sure people are aware, when we say Israel or Israelis, naturally we're not saying all of them. There have been many Israelis that are opposing what their government is doing. When we talk about Zionists, there were some of the early Zionists when they came over and saw the situation in Palestine and realized that their movement would be creating a huge injustice. Some of them said that and opposed it. So this isn't monolithic. There are, you know, some Israelis that are opposed to what their government is doing. There are some young soldiers refusing to take part. But in terms of governmental actions, yes, they've killed large numbers of people. There's very little, there are very few consequences when a soldier kills a child. For example, I think it was around 10 years ago or 8 years ago, I can't remember the specifics right now, an Israeli commander had shot a schoolgirl. I think she was around 12 years old. She was, you know, a little schoolgirl, and he shot her. Then he came up close to sort of, quote, confirm the death, which means he shot her 13 more times at point-blank distance. Fortunately, I suppose this didn't save her life, but what happened is then some of his fellow Israeli soldiers were shocked at that action. They were outraged. They then told the Israeli media about it. So this was reported on. And many soldiers thought, you know, were horrified at what they had seen, blew the whistle, exposed what had been done, and yet there was minimal coverage of that in the United States. And I'm trying to remember, as I recall, the man got off. You know, he was eventually charged with misusing his weapon. He wasn't charged with murder. He was charged with misusing his weapon, and I think he was not even found guilty of that. So the system is extremely corrupt, even when it's not corrupt, even in this case, where some Israeli soldiers themselves divulged to the public what had happened, it still didn't go anywhere. And that's what happens time after time. In the few cases where these Israeli crimes are exposed, and when they are forced to investigate an incident, in almost every case, the perpetrator still gets off, you know, even when they've killed children.
Right. Now, this push for the stealing of Palestine actually started in the 1800s, according to you, with some very, very evil men that made their way into American politics.
Well, there was, the beginning in some ways I date from about the 1880s. There was the first American Zionist conference was around, I believe it was around 1898, the first there are now annual conferences of American Zionism. What happened that was very significant was that in, I believe it was 1914, the leadership of World Zionism that had was in Europe moved to the United States, and a man, a very prominent attorney named Louis Brandeis, who is very famous. There's a university, Brandeis University is named after him. He is well regarded. His judicial opinions are often taught in political science classes. Well, Louis Brandeis became the head of World Zionism. 2 years later, he was a Supreme Court justice named by Woodrow Wilson. There was some controversy over him being confirmed, but he was confirmed. And at that time, normally the practice for a Supreme Court justice is to resign their affiliations. They're supposed to just be neutral. So he pretended, he officially resigned his leadership of World Zionism, but in secrecy, he continued to lead it. This is mentioned in a number of books. If anybody gets my book, and I hope they will, it's not very expensive and it's a very, very quick read, you'll see that everything that I say is thoroughly cited from, I feel, very strong sources, often from Israeli sources. So what happened is that when he was a Supreme Court justice, his loyal lieutenants would come into the Supreme Court chambers, report on what they were doing to push Zionism throughout the United States to every sector of American society, and he would then give them directives to carry out. This was all done secretly for two reasons. One reason is that it was highly improper. This was unethical behavior and completely improper for a Supreme Court justice to do such a thing. The second reason is that some things are more effective if they're done secretly, if nobody knows you're doing them. So that's what they did. And yet most of us don't know this about Louis Brandeis, even though it's in many books. Even his biographer, who is clearly a great fan of Louis Brandeis and is an Israel partisan, even he tells this about Louis Brandeis.
Wow, so they've been using every trick in a book and every trick of every bit of deception just to go around our own system to create the Nation of Israel. What about the offenses that have taken place against the Jewish people that didn't want to leave, the other nations that they were living in peacefully?
That's right. That was another thing that was a surprise to me. As I said, a lot of people don't realize that the Jewish population worldwide was originally opposed to Zionism. In many nations, in not only in the United States, but in England, in Iraq, and in various in Morocco, Jewish leaders would say that they were opposed to Zionism, that they were citizens of the country they were living in, that they had no interest in moving to a different place and forcing the people out. Religious leaders felt that Zionism was heretical, that it was God who had dispersed Jews because they had broken the covenant, and they would come back when God brought them back, not through force of arms and not through a secular movement, which is what Zionism was. So Zionists, however, wanted all Jews to go back there. You know, they were fanatically believed that all Jews had to come back, supposedly come back to Palestine, even though there's quite a bit of evidence that many European Jews and many Jewish Americans actually have no ancestry in that area. But they were saying, okay, they all have to go to Palestine to create a Jewish state. And when not everyone would go, they would sort of force them to go. There would be false flag incidents, as there were in Iraq, where there would be, when Zionism really began to be very militant in the 1940s, they would have cases where, and then after Israel was created, secret Israeli agents would place bombs in synagogues and make it look that this that these were being done by the Muslim Brotherhood to frighten the local Jewish population that had lived there for centuries without any problem, to make them think, well, suddenly there was this animosity and hostility and aggression against Jews, and they would therefore flee Iraq and some of the other places in the Middle East and go to Israel. This was consciously done by Israeli agents, and it was written about by some Iraqi Jews, one of which specifically wrote an article about it, and he had taken part in it. So he wrote about what was done from the inside.
Well, can we actually look at Germany and say that the Holocaust was pretty much a part of the Zionist agenda to scare people out of Germany because they needed the population?
Well, I wouldn't put it, what I would say is that they exploited the Holocaust to help their agenda of creating a Jewish state in Palestine. What happened is there are a number of connections that Zionists had to the Holocaust and the ways that they used it. They didn't, you know, of course they didn't create it or aren't responsible for it, but there are a number of significant connections to how they used that tragedy. And one of the most significant is that there were efforts when the Nazis were coming to power, and then once they were in power and as things got worse and worse, there were refugee efforts around the world to try to help Jewish people flee the area and have places to go for refuge. FDR especially was pushing that. He named a representative, Morris Ernst, to help on that, where they would have the Evian conference, for example, to find ways where countries would all agree to take Jewish refugees and to, you know, help them that way. But the Zionists didn't like that because then it would show that there were many places that Jews could live safely, and therefore it would take away from their objective of trying to say, no, all Jews have to go to Palestine, that's the only way they'll be safe. They felt if they were safe in other places, then that would undermine the Zionist movement. So they would actually actively sabotage those efforts to create refuges for Jews fleeing the Nazis. It's been written about quite a bit. It's been exposed quite a bit. Again, a number of books have been written about it. And yet it's been very, very few of us know that fact.
Right. The attacks on the churches by the Zionists, I believe in one of the statements where one person had stated to the Israelis that they're, I guess it was one of the ambassadors that stated that they were attacking the churches, they told him to take his dead Jesus and go home?
That's right. This was a Dead Sea scholar. A friend of his had been told by one of the Zionists, a Zionist, that, you know, when we win, you can take your dead Jesus and go home. A really shocking statement, but it's from a reliable source, so I have no doubt that that is just what was said. And during the war, Israel calls it its War of Independence. That was about fall of 1947 through 1949. The Palestinians call it Al-Nakba, the catastrophe, because it was a huge humanitarian catastrophe. Massive death and carnage and people forced out of their homes, never allowed to return, hundreds of thousands of them. And during that war of independence, there was a plan in which as many non-Jews as possible would be pushed out. Because, you know, how can you have a Jewish state if the majority of the population living there is not Jewish? So they had to be pushed out. It was written about, there's a plan called, I think it was called Plan Dalet. And so it wasn't only Muslims that were being pushed out. It was, of course, Palestinian Christians as well. Donald Neff, who was a former Time Magazine bureau chief and the author of 5 books on Israel-Palestine, reported in detail some of the Zionist attacks on Christian sites in 1948. a group of Christian leaders complained that very month, May 1948, Zionists had killed and wounded hundreds of people, including children and clergy, at Christian churches and humanitarian institutions. There's a quote where he says that many children were killed or wounded by Jewish shells on the convent of Orthodox Copt. Refugees were killed at the Armenian convent. A Catholic priest had been killed. Two more had been wounded at a church of St. Mark. There was a great deal of violence against Muslims and against Christians, really against both equally. A Catholic priest said, quote, "Jewish soldiers broke down the doors of my church and robbed many precious and sacred objects. They threw the statues of Christ down into a nearby garden." All of this is documented. It's shocking. I don't actually find it pleasant to have to be the one to tell about this, but that's what went on. That type of behavior still goes on. And again, it's not by all Israelis, but this is a systemic situation in which the government encourages, allows, and sometimes perpetrates these types of actions. We just usually don't learn about them.
Yeah, well, it seems like they've got a very, very tight grip on not just the government here in the United States, but a lot of the governments around the world.
Well, there's a very powerful pro-Israel lobby in the United States. You know, everybody in Washington, D.C. connected with politics knows that. There's a powerful Israel lobby in Britain as well. I don't think it's quite as strong, but it's very significant. Certainly seems to be significant in France and elsewhere. Not as much as in the United States, but it has a certain amount of power throughout Europe. So it's a movement that many people are fearful to speak out against or to go against. It can damage your career. You get called nasty names. The minute you say anything critical of Israel, you're called, quote, anti-Semitic. Even if you have a life history, as I do, of opposing all types of bigotry. Even many Jewish activists are speaking out about what Israel is doing, criticizing it, quite powerfully, writing books about it. And even though they're Jewish, they're called anti-Semitic for giving that kind of information. So, you know, this is a tactic that silences many people. Often it's just being called names silences people. In other cases, sometimes a lot of money is mobilized so that, for example, in the United States with politicians, when you run for office, especially national office, it takes a great deal of money. And if a party that cares about a particular issue, as in this particular case, Israel, if they are going to donate large sums of money to politicians on behalf of that Israel, then they will distort the whole political system. You know, this has been done with other issues as well, but right now the one that we're talking about is Israel-Palestine. And we find that candidates from both parties, national, for president, for Congress, for Senate, continually both parties will the individuals will be saying almost identical things. We are devoted to Israel. We will defend Israel no matter what. We love Israel no matter what. Even when Israel has just massacred a few thousand people in Gaza, they're still saying the same thing for political expediency, to either get the campaign money for themselves or to at least make sure it doesn't go to their opponent. That's
all right.
The system.
Yeah, I know. And I'm sorry to cut you off real quick. We need to take a break, and we'll be right back with my guest, Allison Weir. And we will be discussing the Palestine-Israel issue right here on The People Speak.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
Welcome back to The People Speak. This is Rock Cash with our guest, Allison Weir. We're talking about her book, Against Our Better Judgment. Allison, when we left off, we're talking about the grip of Zionism on politics. How can we get around that? How can we get our politicians to adhere to us and not to big money? I mean, we need to stop these corporations that are pretty much working on behalf of Zionism.
Yes, I very much agree. I think we obviously campaign finance reform is extremely important. It distorts this issue. It distorts many other issues. So this is, I feel, across the political spectrum, we don't want corporations and we don't want our politicians bought. You know, even if they're on our side, I don't think that's the kind of system that is healthy for our country or for our children or that we want. So we need to make sure, we need to somehow get campaign finance reform enacted. That's extremely important. In the meantime, until that's done, grassroots movements can sometimes counter money. You know, this has happened in the past. So until we have campaign finance reform, what we can do, and I think it's possible, is share the information with other people. Once enough people in a congressional district start saying, we don't want this policy, it is a failed policy, we need our money here, it's time to stop sending $10 million a day to Israel. All that does is perpetuate violence that hurts everybody, creates very dangerous hostility to the United States, is a major factor in why ISIS has grown up, is over Israel and over U.S. support and Western support of Israel, that if we would stop our support of Israel, if we would stop financing Israel, that would alleviate a great many problems throughout the world. When enough of us tell that to our candidates, then our politicians will do what we want or they'll lose the election.
Well, I don't want to go away off the subject, but my feelings are ISIS are out there killing Muslims, and they're not attacking Israel, so I don't understand where ISIS is playing the role of being against America. It seems that they're doing what the American politicians want them to do. They're destroying Iraq, and they are destroying Syria, and we know that we've been trying to go to war with Syria, but now Obama's sending planes in there and everything else when they know, because they know that the people are against the war in Syria. But I don't see ISIS being a threat to Israel.
Well, I agree. I mean, ISIS is a strange, to me, it's a strange phenomenon. Because, as you say, it's not attacking Israel that I've seen. And there certainly are, seem to be Israeli connections at time and at times and American connections to it. However, I think that a lot of the people that are joining it are, and again, I don't pretend to be an expert on ISIS, so these are just my own personal conjectures.
Right.
But certainly a lot of the hostility that compels people, usually they're not religious that are joining ISIS, or at least in many cases they don't have a history of a religious background. But I think seeing what the U.S., Israel, and the West have done to places like Iraq and to Palestine has created animosity toward what we're doing. And I think many of the people that go over to join ISIS are motivated by that kind of anger and outrage at what Israeli forces and American forces have done in the Middle East. That has been a recruiting tool, even if that's not really what ISIS is about necessarily.
Right. And another thing, a topic I wanted to hit is, we know that clergy here in the U.S. was used against the American Christians in order to gain support for the Zionist state of Israel. And, of course, the media had played the roles in making the movies and calling Jesus the King of the Jews when Jesus was never a Jew.
Well,
Jesus was never Yiddish. I don't recall Jesus being in Europe at all.
Well, he wasn't Europe, and certainly the way he's portrayed is probably not very accurate when you think about what the demography of Palestine was at that time. I don't think he had blonde hair and blue eyes, probably. Now, whether he was a Jew, most people, I think, do think that he was. That's certainly what I grew up believing.
Well,
but
he was a Judean of the
that's
of
what
the
I was
Israelites.
That right. Often there are interpretations that make quite a bit of sense, that when you actually read what the original statement about Jews were, that they were called Judeans, which may well have been a geographic designation, rather than the way that we use the term Jew today. But that's not in my book. That's not something it's something I've read about that I think it's very interesting to look into. But it's not something that I have included in my book and have not studied enough to feel I'm an expert on that at all.
Yeah, well, theology is a little bit hard, but let's talk about the use of the clergy here in the United States and how they were deceived into going along with the agenda, and how certain Christians went along with the Zionist agenda in order, I guess, for personal gain, mostly.
Well, in some cases, that seems to be the case. Jerry Falwell was bought a jet plane by Israel, so that certainly contributed to his fame and celebrity and reach, whereas other fundamentalist evangelical Christian leaders that did not teach a kind of theology that benefited Israel, that they weren't given a jet plane or the kind of money to make them famous and to have the kind of reach that someone like Jerry Falwell does. Early on, there were certainly the Zionist movement was working to go, as I said, to go after every sector of American society. They targeted Jewish war veterans for propaganda. They also targeted Christian clergy. They started some supposedly Christian groups that were funded with money that was from the Zionist movement to make Christians sympathetic toward Zionism. This was actively done back in the 40s. I think there was some of that was going on in the 20s, and there's some evidence it was happening even sooner than that.
Yeah, it's amazing how they get to control people with finances. The thing is, and I'm trying to figure out a way to put this without being too offensive, a lot of Jews were against the creation of the State of Israel, and they knew that it was going to be harmful to the population that was there, and it would continue to be harmful. And they knew before going into this that this battle would last forever because the indigenous people don't want to leave their land, just as the Jews didn't want to leave their homes in Germany and Iraq and in other Arab nations. But, you know, once again, they attacked them to scare them. But now when you talk to Jews of today, and mostly Israelis or Zionists and stuff like that, they tried to put out the simulation that Palestine never existed. You know, they go into the legal mumbo-jumbo and the BS trying to derail Palestine, but the people of the land were always there.
That's right. They were. Their arguments are usually so weak that they just resort often to either fabricated, really untruths, or defamation of people they don't like. You know, they attack the messenger because they cannot attack the content of the information. It seems to be strategies. In fact, sometimes these are written up into documents where you can read what the strategy is. And one of the talking points that I've always felt was a sort of foolish one was, Palestine never existed. Well, of course it existed. You can look at old maps and it's called Palestine. The original colonial schemes that the Zionists had were usually called the Palestine Colonial Project, for example. You know, it was not a nation before, but that doesn't, you know, most of the world wasn't organized into nations for many years. Germany wasn't a nation for many years. It's really a specious argument that makes no sense. Palestinians were there, people were there. They have a long documented presence in the land. The demographic composition of the land has been known quite well through Ottoman records and also through the British records when they took over Palestine in approximately 1920. So we have lots of population records that show the breakdown of the inhabitants. This is all thoroughly known. So whether it was a nation state called Palestine doesn't really matter. There was a region called Palestine. There were people living there. And this movement came to push the people out that were living there. It's a very simple situation. Wow. It was one of the first massive ethnic cleansings of the 20th century.
Well, I can just imagine what would have happened to the Zionists if they would have went with one of the plans, considerations for a Zionist state, and that was Texas. Can you imagine what the Texans would have done?
Exactly. Nobody is going to just voluntarily leave their land. You know, that's just not the way people act. Now, the Zionists, I think, some of them, there were statements where they said, well, they'll just forget about it. You know, it's not likely, but I think maybe they were deluding themselves into thinking, we can just push them out or we can buy them out and they'll just forget. But, of course, people don't forget. And the other point I think it's important to make is that many people today think that Israelis bought up all, you know, the people that at least know enough to know that there were people there before the Zionist state of Israel was created. But they're led to believe, well, Israel bought up all that land, therefore it gets to keep it. But it did not. They tried to. They did. There was a lot of wealth behind them at a certain point. Sometimes the Rothschild family, for example, and some other banking families were funding some of these projects. So they did make a great effort to get rid of the people by buying up the land that way and then pushing them off, because sometimes they would buy it up from absentee landlords. But they didn't succeed. They did increase Jewish ownership quite a bit. Originally, the Jewish population in that area was very urban. So they only owned about 1% of the land, even though there were, you know, probably about 4% of the population. They were largely congregated in some urban areas. They owned about 1% of the land. After decades of trying to buy it up, they still owned only approximately 6% of the land.
Right, you know, because so
they didn't buy it all. They just eventually took it through warfare.
Right, because the people did not want to leave. The people were forced out. You know, this is the rhetoric that I hear all the time that, oh, we bought up the land. No, it's stolen land. It was never paid for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a massive theft. You know, it's astounding when you think about it. In my book, I I have the figure. I'm sorry, I don't remember it off the top of my hand, my head. But, you know, they stole wonderful land. A lot of it's along the Mediterranean. It's fertile land, parts of it. You know, it used to be called, in ancient times, the land of milk and honey. It had wonderful olive, orange groves, olive groves. It does today, to a degree. So this was very valuable land. There were also major cities on it. There was Jerusalem, an ancient city. You can see photographs of what it was like at that time when they began this movement, and then on into the 40s. They stole shops, schools, extremely valuable land. You know, this is a massive burglary when you think about how much money, how much wealth was confiscated. And this is not legal today to do. In today's world, now maybe back in, you know, ancient times, of course, this is what went on. But today we have international law. We have war.
That is never follows, by the way.
That's right. It consistently violates international regulations and even covenants that they're signatories to, they violate. But this is, you cannot just go and take people's land anymore. That's not allowed. So what Israel has taken, it is taken illegally, especially in the West Bank and Gaza. You know, especially the West Bank, those so-called settlements, are illegally confiscated land. That's what's going on. And they continually, quote, expand those settlements, taking more and more land. All of this is really just a polite word for theft.
Well, it's an evil process that's being allowed to move forward by our elected officials here in the United States. They can put a stop to it within a matter of minutes, but it seems that they're just trying to play the games, or they're not strong mm-hmm. enough, or shall I say, and sorry, please excuse my French, but our politicians need to grow some balls and stop being little bitches for the Zionist agenda.
But, you know, to be fair, let's pretend that you and I were politicians and we actually got elected to Congress and we decided to stand up on the congressional floor and say what needs to be said. What would happen is, you know, our next election would be two years away. Zionist Israel partisans would funnel massive amounts of money to our opponents. They would influence the media. Most people, we wouldn't have enough of a movement on the side of justice. So more than likely, in 2 years, we would be voted out of office because the candidate that has the most money usually has the best political campaign. They have wonderful advertising. They have wonderful billboards and talking points and political teams.
Which I think we need to stop.
Only we the people can
stop this. The donations and the media, the advertisements and everything else. I want people running on their merits, not their good looks.
I agree. But I think that's our job. And I thank you, because this is the kind, we need programs that talk about this, that educate people, that inform them and hopefully motivate people. More Americans need to become politically active. We're abdicating our civic responsibilities when we just sort of say, oh, there's nothing we can do or things are okay. Both are a cop-out. You know, those who just say, well, there's nothing we can do, that's a cop-out. And those who think everything's okay are not paying attention, because everything is not okay. It's time for more of us to get involved and make people aware that we are going to now vote on this issue, that this is critical for the region and for the people here in the United States as well. And it's time that we start building a movement of that sort. We can't just blame the politicians. We have to do our part, too. And you are doing your part.
I think people are just too busy being divided. I wish people would stop being diplomats and Democrats and Republicans, and I wish that they would all return to being Americans. Instead of being divided, they need to come together and put their foot down, and this is the only way that we can control our government the way we were supposed to control it in the first place. The Jews figured out how to control it. We, the people, can figure out how to take it back.
Well, and I wouldn't say the Jews, because again...
I'm sorry, the Zionists.
Yeah, exactly. There is a significant difference there. And I think especially among the younger Jewish American students, for example, don't have, you know, many of the older population were targeted with this kind of Many, sadly, are supportive of Israel. I think sometimes they don't know quite what they're supporting, but that's the reality that many do, but not all. But especially among younger Jewish Americans, many of them are now becoming more knowledgeable about what's going on, and many are saying, I don't agree with this. This does not represent me. So again, it's all of us need to look into the facts and decide that we want principled moral policies, and I think we can all come together and change those policies. We just have to do that.
And what do you think about the big Zionist picture, and that's global dominization? You know, that seems to be the direction that they're going to with the governments and everything else, the New World Order and the global government. We hear this every single day in the media. So we know that there's a Zionist push for that.
My analysis sees a movement that's pushing to protect Israel, using every means possible, almost, to do that. And certainly influencing governments around the world and media to further that particular agenda. I don't really see evidence of trying to control the entire world and some sort of world domination. I don't see the evidence for that. I see this as a more limited type of agenda. Now, within the Zionists, there are certainly more extreme individuals and groups that would set the boundaries of Israel far greater than most people think. You know, sometimes they say from the river to the sea, which means from the Nile to the Euphrates. So certainly the boundaries of Israel, there's a real question about how Israel has never set its boundaries. So some people, you know, almost all Israel partisans certainly go beyond the Green Line, which was the armistice line from 1949, in which they took 78% of Palestine. Some see all of Mandate Palestine as potentially Israel. In fact, that's what Israeli maps often show. They completely ignore the Palestinian territories, as the fact is they're not annexed by Israel, they're not part of Israel, but Israel maps often show them to be. But there are portions, a small portion of the Israeli public, that believe Israel gets even more land than that. That's you know, those extremists set the boundaries much larger.
Yeah, they did. We're running out of time, and I'm really hating this, but I would love to have you back again sometime in the near future, Allison, so we can go into more details about your book and the history. And I've gotten most of the way through your book, and now I'm working on the endnotes. Massive information in the book. Please go out and get the book. It's called Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the United States Was Used to Create Israel. And this is Rock Cash saying goodbye for this week. We will join you back here next week on The People Speak. And special thanks to Don Newsom at the BBS Radio Network for bringing us live. Thank you, Don. Thank you, Allison. Everyone have a good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.